I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, in conversation with the 15th and youngest music director in 133 years of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Andris Nelsons. You are hearing the sound of his formal debut conducting an institution on the rebound. This is the overture to Wagner's opera Tannhäuser. An overture perhaps to Maestro Nelson's big vision to bring life to music. It could run darker, stranger, more often operatic than Boston is used to, reaching for emotional force on top of the BSO's famous finesse. Andris Nelson, at 36, is younger than most of his players and most of his audience. Though he's already an international star, well-traveled as a guest conductor with the great ensembles of Berlin, Vienna, Munich, and Paris, and deeply versed in the repertoire after 6 years with the CBSO, England's City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. Andris Nelson likes to speak of the architecture of music, so we're curious, what is he building here in Boston, leading the next generation of symphonic performers in search of a new generation of listeners? He's playing on a global scorecard too. The whole musical world is watching and listening to Andris Nelson's, and I'm asking him how he feels that pressure.
I mean, of course, this is one of the world's best orchestras with, the best concert hall in America. I would say one of the best concerts, in the world. And of course, I think I always knew with this feeling that, Boston, it is kind of a cultural center of the United States, because of the universities, the orchestra, and everything around. And it's so, of course, it's a big responsibility and big pressure in that sense. But of course, it's a great excitement. I'm thinking of just... really in childish way, that it's like having a Ferrari, you drive a Ferrari and you have to know how to switch on the gas but this is such amazing orchestra. I'm just enjoying, but I understand, and of course I feel the great responsibility because of the great tradition and the great quality and expectations as well. Yes,
Boston is a Ferrari. That's fun to think about. You, just jumping way ahead, in the City of Birmingham Orchestra, you said you wanted it to be, under your leadership, the most passionate orchestra in the United Kingdom. What's the adjective you would put on the Boston that you want to build?
From one hand, of course, it is a continuation of this great tradition, which is a great respect and great admiring of that. Starting with the great maestros of Russian, Koussevitzky, of course, and the French, and of course Seiji, and of course also American with Maestro Levine, so this is a great tradition which I want to, of course, to be part of. Of course,
and some people still say they hear the Charles Munch French finesse in this orchestra, in the DNA. Can that be?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, I think this is like all orchestras with the great tradition, old tradition. You can still feel, whether it's Vienna or Gewandhaus, we just heard a few days ago, you're playing, of course, in Boston, you feel the tradition and the sound somehow in this DNA, in even though there's nobody playing from the times of 100 years ago. But of course, the tradition passes, and that's very, to me as a European, it's very, very important. Tradition is very important because we can't invent a bicycle. We shouldn't. We have to value and pass the tradition. That's very important, one part. But from the other importance, I think this is actually respecting and continuing the tradition is to not... I can't say not to be a museum value. It is a combination of 100 to 150 or more years ago. But when we play and perform music, this is about, it is about today. It is about what we feel, what we felt, what we will feel. So the music is about love, about hate, about even politics, and about everything what has been in life since the world has been created. So therefore, it's very actual. It is not like you go to a museum and see, and then it is the combination of these things. And therefore, I think What we still have, of course, in Birmingham, this is my last year. This always was aiming for passion and the humanity and the emotionality in music. Plus, of course, the intellectual side, of course, but I mean to have a burning desire to infect the audience with the emotionality what the music brings, and therefore to be very sensual, flexible, emotional, and intellectual at the same time, bringing also the tradition. So it's this is, I think, very important to be that we are human beings, that we show our emotions, that we, if you want to smile, we smile. If you don't want, we don't smile. But it is, so there is no boundaries in the sense of, oh, probably it might look, if I'm too emotional, it might look not good. Or and the music is this expression of our heart and our soul. So I think this, we need to communicate through music.
Let me say, you've got it right. We hear it and we see it when we hear you play. It's very striking the way you've animated this hall in just a few weeks and a few concerts. But I also want to say it's very striking to me that everything you play, all your music making, sounds like a personal statement. It does seem to come from Andras Nelson's in a certain way. It's deeply invested with your own heart and mind and experience, which is why I wanted to begin with your story. I'm fascinated by the boy who grew up between the Soviet occupation of Latvia and its modern independence, grew up in a musical family, also between the Russian and the German empires, which were at war in the 40s before your birth, but in a sense, they're also empires of music. Tchaikovsky, Wagner, this was the stuff of your childhood in a way, and I'd love you to walk us through it.
Yes, this is even in my early age now, I mean, maybe I'm not as young anymore, but as a conductor still, experiencing two different, absolutely different regimes. And, one is Soviet, which is a communist. And of course, thanks God, not as, as extreme as, Stalin or Lenin or, the extreme times of where Shostakovich lived and this times. But still, it was, when I was born, 78, it's still, I was 12 years old when the Soviet Union collapsed, but I realized how special actually it was. It changed also and developed the emotional attitude to world, to music and to world generally, and these two different absolutely worlds, and then changing from the Soviet to independence, going through a great nationalistic patriotic feelings, passing that on, 89, 90, when, we gain our independence. And then even as a boy, still I have these memories. And then, of course, going to the big influence of Western Europe, to the capitalism, and then, of course, also America, of course. And so going from one to another world in these, actually, for me, transition of these 2-3 years is extreme change. So now I think it's a part of is a norm for me. But actually, when I realize it's a huge, huge, I can't say it's a huge privilege to live uncomfortable life. But culturally and humanly, I have experienced a great influence and I think development as a person through that. And of course, if you ask, it all started with the studies in the Soviet Union, in Latvia, which was an extremely strong regime, but also a strong cultural tradition, with the Russian music and education was very strong. And I must say the good thing was really that every school had the music lessons. You could learn an instrument. I'm not talking about music schools. There were a lot of music schools. Every second, third child went to music school because that was a normal, way to develop, a young person through music and through sport. I would say these two things were very, very strong. Of course, that's probably one of the ways how they didn't want people to start going too much in religion or not doing it at all, because they say there is no God. Of course, you could go to church, but it was not really accepted. So they didn't want that you could express yourself through going into the religion or any religion, whether
but
it's Christian.
But music was acceptable.
But music was acceptable.
Interesting.
And of course, through music, you could express your inside world, your soul, and through sport, you could express your physical. But you know, a physical necessity to train, and also you could express your anger through music or through sport. But you know, the propaganda, it was very strong. And of course, I can imagine how it influenced, you know, also the composers or earlier, you know, like Shostakovich or Gubadul, you know, or Shnitke or any of them. Even in my generation, I experienced this feeling that that's the right regime. I simply didn't know how it is live. Nobody was know how it is to live or to be outside. First time, so really believing that, I was playing piano, studying music school piano, started to play trumpet, you know, Gorbachev's time, and then independence, actually the perestroika, so-called, you know, where things started to shake. And of course, then came this gaining of independence, which of course also happened in a way very... Not, I can't say suddenly, but very unbelievably, because nobody would really think that would happen. And I experienced that, of course. And then came, you know, these patriotic ideas. We are Latvians, we are non-Russians, we are Latvians. And very strong our cultural identity with the singing, you know, the choir singing, you know, there's open air festival for choirs. I mean, almost 30,000 people just singing outside, and it was a time of very nationalistic feeling.
Coming up, some of the unlikely, mystical new music that Anders Nilsson's has in his kit for Boston, including the Offertorium, inspired by Bach, from a Russian contemporary, Sofia Gubaidulina. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. We're in the conductor's green room with Anders Nilsson's, the new music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. He's just getting started on the roots of his music in Russia, in emotionality, in his upbringing in Latvia. This is so interesting to me and quite what I sort of suspected. First of all, that the Soviet repression forced so much energy, curiosity, teamwork into music and into your education as a vehicle for expressing and discovering incredibly profound things, but also the public musical culture. In the legend anyway, the anti-Soviet Baltic resistance in the 80s was called not the Velvet Revolution, but the Singing Revolution. There was a lot of music sort of to build on. Let me just ask, who are your Latvians that you grew up in? The ones I think of first, Isaiah Berlin, diplomat, settled in England, became a great writer, philosopher of freedom. I'm also Mark Rothko, the painter, those giant blobs of color, was a Latvian. Michael Baryshnikov, I didn't know till recently that he was a Latvian.
Yeah.
Sergei Eisenstein, the film director.
Mm-hmm.
What did it mean for a young man in the 80s and 90s to be, I'm a Latvian?
Yes,
what's that about?
I think it has probably changed through this time when I have lived in my life. Of course, at first, I was a Latvian, but part of Russia. It was a strange feeling, you know, being 10-year-old or 8-year-old. You're talking Latvian, but you're not. It's not your country. I mean, it's your country, but your country is Soviet Union. So you're that feeling. Then, of course, independence came. So people started to talk what really happened in the history, or to start to open the doors to the truth, or maybe exaggerated truth could be as well. I mean, sometimes what happens now also maybe it's in a way sometimes exaggerated one or other direction politically things go. But anyway, we found, you know, about the truth, so you could express yourself and say, well, actually, you know, Stalin killed so many people, and the biggest problem, of course, one thing is. What of course is he was fighting with a Nazi, and of course that's another disastrous thing with Hitler, and so that's of course one thing. But if you destroy so many millions of your own people, you know, sending them to Siberia, and mostly the intelligence, that was a crime, because, you know, because Russia before the Lenin and you know, all the Tsar, you know, it was still, I think, of course, I was not but you know, the intelligence, when you see Tchaikovsky, or I mean, in this time people spoke French, and the big, I was just watching yesterday also documentary about Stravinsky, how when he born, you know, all this intelligence was really very, very high, and the cultural level was very high. And of course, when the Bolsheviks, or you know, this came, they, you know, they changed everything. So of course, and the worst thing, of course, they destroyed their own people, and that is, I think, the biggest crime. But anyway, and that's why in the 90s we could talk about this and say what bad things the regime has done. There were also good things, education and the cultural richness of culture, you know, the great composers like Shostakovich, you know, which Prokofiev, or of course Stravinsky, but he was already out, or Rachmaninov. But then we could talk about what really happened. People thought, oh, you know, my family was killed there. And then, of course, this, and we wanted to get back the independence, what was, you know, before the Second World War. So from musical perspective, what I can say in these years, and that was the years where I started to play trumpet and started to study his conducting, we had a big goal. Not a goal to, you know, to get a lot of money, but to get the highest, you know, quality of music making. We wanted to be like, you know, like whether it was Maurice Jansons, or like Karajan, or like, yeah, or like Oistrakh, or violinists, or, you know, whatever. We had examples of what we want to be and to aim for as a musicians. And that was a good thing, which we have lost, and I think the whole world has lost. Now people say, oh, I want to do that because I can earn good money by that. And of course, you have to think about these things, because that's the system, again, the capitalism is. But I think that was a great time of the idealistic thinking. And the music was the expression of your soul, of your emotionality, and also on your political views and your inside world. So through music, you express that. And actually, I remember when I played trumpet, I practiced 6-8 hours a day, you know, my lip was bleeding, and I was practicing because I wanted to become a good trumpet player, you know, and this was the time when everyone was extremely hard practicing, whether it's music or sport, and so therefore maybe many of my colleagues, musicians from these countries, from Latvia or Estonia, Lithuania or other Bulgaria, you know, they at this age, they really reached very high positions simply because they worked very hard and very intensive at that time.
This is such a fascinating thing, a sort of nationalism expressed in music.
Yeah, and that's because that could be expressed, I mean, some people, of course, did, you know, expressed in politics, and you know, of course, there was a new political party, and then, but they obviously didn't do much always very good, but at least musicians or the sport people, or they got a great positions in you know, and a great,
better to do it in music. It sounds it sounds like Cuba to me. Yeah. Cuba has the same sort of repressed politics, but absolutely explosive music, always has.
Yeah,
and maybe sports too.
Yes, I think that was at least how I feel. And of course, then came much bigger influence, of course, of as you told, when you were in Latvia, 97 or 98 and 2000, when we needed to decide whether we want to be part of NATO or the European Union, and all you know, the contracts and with the Western Europe, with the United States. So then it started to, you know, the capitalism started to develop, because it was all, you know, the people who worked in all these administrative works or any other, they were just got used to one way. And that was difficult. It's this kind of transitional part, so for many people, for many people, particularly, I feel very bad for old people who at that time were 50, 60, who would need to get their pensions. They simply didn't get anything. They lost their jobs. They couldn't. So this was also time of very difficult socially, and you know, many people didn't have work, and also people on streets started to appear, you know, and so-called tramps. And so this was also very difficult times.
I'm struck by two things. One, did a young Latvian like you dream all day of getting to the West, going to Europe or to Moscow and get out of here?
Yes, that was very, I must say, in the 90s, most of, I don't know how it was for other students, but let's say music students, they all wanted to study in Western Europe. And many went to study to Germany or Austria or some to the United States as well. But that was then started this kind of practicing hard in order to get out from Latvia. For me, it was strangely, I went to St. Petersburg in the same time when everybody else went to the West. I went to study conducting in St. Petersburg because, still is the capital, culture capital of Russia is still St. Petersburg, you know, because and the great architecture and simply there was amazing conducting school, you know, the conducting pianists and composers as well. But so many conductors come from that school, what is in what was in St. Petersburg, still there, but not as strong. St. Petersburg was very good for studying music and for studying conducting, so that's why I went there, simply because of that reason. So I think the political, this over-nationalistic idea, so we have to get rid of all Russians, it's firstly not possible. Secondly,
we hear much too much about the politicians, much too little about the artists. But can I just say, one of the joys of watching the Metropolitan Opera on these, you know, live telecasts, HD telecasts in theaters around the world, is we see these Russian singers. I mean, maybe Anna Netrebko is the most famous, but Dmitry Vorostovsky and lots of others. You think, holy mackerel, they've been producing such stupendous artists all the time of that turmoil. Mm-hmm. Some steady beat and development of Russian music or Western music in Russia that we forgot about. And one of the joys of listening to you and looking at your programming is that you bring some of these people, including your wife.
Yeah, my wife, soprano.
Yes, yes. We're seeing sort of some of the people who grew up with you or in your cadre, your generation, and they're fantastic. I mean, I think it's one of your gifts to our town so far.
I have to say thanks to the destiny that it put me through all of us difficulties, but that we, through these difficulties, we could develop as a human beings and as a musician.
Before we leave Russia, though, I just wanted you to speak something about Sofia Gubaidulina. You've mentioned her a couple of times, and the performance of her offertorium was so incredibly powerful. To me, the hearing the music and reading, knowing something of her story, she appeared here like 25 years ago, and we saw her. But this, it sounded like a sort of a metaphor of the whole Russian story. This woman who really calls herself a Tartar, more than a Russian, but she sort of left the cultural capitals, has worked entirely on her own, still alive, but music to be discovered maybe in 1,000 years, music for all time, music beyond politics, reflecting the repression of the society, but a sort of beautifully kept secret. I wondered how you made it that difficult offertorium, in a certain way difficult, so many individual piccolo, piano, vibraphone, spread out, disassembled uses of that melody and that theme. You could have heard a pin drop in the hall as you were playing. People were sort of breathless listening to your Gubaidulina, and I wondered what does that tell you?
Yes, well, it tells how great the piece is, and we all were serving for this great composer and for music at that moment. It's not me, or for what is important, we can get emotionally to the music only if we open our hearts. I mean, that's why, you know, when we, at the beginning we started to say what we want to succeed. And this is one of the things, to open the hearts of all musicians to join, because the professionality is extremely high, it's the highest professionality. But and to combine it with the sincerity and heart and emotions, that's then you can start, I think, really producing the atmosphere, what all of the composers wanted to create. And of course, Gubay Dudin is a very strong piece with a, you know, if you don't get the atmosphere of that music, it's you know, you are failed, I think, the concert is failed, because you need to have this feeling of breathless or of horror also, and at the end, you know, this sad but also extremely beautiful and comforting feeling. Comfort through religion, or comfort through God, whatever religion it is. It's just, you know, of course, also use of Bach. It gives Bach always, because it reminds, you know, of course, of the purity and of the most things in order and most spiritual somehow. This orthodox kind of a big long period of this music, which is seems like beyond this world, you know. Sad, dramatic, but it's also, there's something pure and comforting at the same time. But I think it's somehow a feeling for me that the comfort we get is probably in the religion, and it might not even be in this life. So it's in a way sad, but also because of, I was actually brought up as a religious person, as a Christian, so I always, of course, the God was very important, is a very important part of also, you know, my personality, and it gives the comfort. It gives even more questions and more doubt, but it also gives the comfort or the idea of resurrection. And I think that's very important. If you don't have idea of resurrection or of something, then you are stuck. I think every composer goes through that. It doesn't matter which nationality and which political background. Mahler went through that, and of course also Shostakovich and Tchaikovsky, and as well as Gubay Dudin, I think. So it is therefore always the end. It's somehow, it's sad, but there is always, it gives always the feeling that there is a comfort somewhere. Through religion, but that's what I think this piece is also so strong, because it also combines this, you know, avant-garde technique of composing, which is, you know, the dissonant and so on, but because it is so much to do with actually the emotional background, then I think for audience, tonality and atonality becomes secondary, you know.
Yes.
At that moment she hypnotizes us, and we don't say it anymore, oh, that was a dissonant chord, what, it's probably not for me. You, at that moment you say, yes, I don't know what was that, but it's so, you know, I feel I can't talk, or so it's so, that's because I think it comes, the brain and in intellect and professionality with the technique, you know, of composition technique, and our, you know, of the contemporary way, of course, but because there is the reason for composing is emotional reason, to express the emotionality or express yourself. And I think if you have that, then actually, then I think it's no, for my understanding, whether it's a Beethoven, Mahler, Gesualdo or you know Ogubaduljin or Harbison or you know there is no borders or saying oh that's atonal that's tonal so it's probably I will not like atonal music. Of course I'm talking generally, but of course if music is if the music is written because of the background of the emotional or you know reason. Then I think it always talks to people, and of course we have to perform it. Also, the way that we believe and we want to show the music from the all sides, not only technically, compositionally, but also emotionally. That's what we need to, and we're trying to all you know, and to always fulfill this all these parts.
Coming up, the conductor's process and his unusual relationship with orchestra players. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. We're speaking with Andris Nelsons, the new music director at the BSO, about his vision and his music. I told him, in everything Russian, I'm always listening for traces of the novelist Dostoevsky. For his orthodox soul, his darkness, his grandeur, and a particular kind of redemptive energy.
Yes, I agree. This is, from one sense, it's, of course, also that is a different in maybe particularly in Russian, you know, in Russian or in the, I suppose, Soviet, but particularly Russian, Soviet, and also non-Soviet, even as you told, Tchaikovsky or Rachmaninov or... this is yeah this redemption, but it's very mystic, it's very dark. So you don't feel it. It's not the redemption of even of Mahler or something. You know, when you get this the second symphony of Mahler, you really feel I'm going to you know I can die tomorrow and I will wake up day after tomorrow. You know, when you listen to Resurrection of I don't know or any kind of redemption of in Russian music, you don't have a feeling that you're going to wake up tomorrow, even though you feel that there is a future. It is more mystic and it's more dark. It should be hoped, but it doesn't sound very hopeful. But of course, it's religious in the same time. So,
what are your favorite pieces expressing that kind of mystery?
Symphonic dances is certainly of Rachmaninov, of course. Shostakovich, for me, it personally also very much goes through that, but it is in a different way. He doesn't directly connect you immediately with the religion, I think. It somehow goes, he finds the way, at least not telling, oh, you're going to, you know, resurrect because of there is a religion, you know. He goes through this suffer and gets out of that through irony, through sarcasm, but he never really gives you this easy way of deserving anything. But it still feels to me that this is connected with God and with this idea of life after this one. But of course, I would say, but from the really religious perspective, I think it's more, of course, I think it's more Rachmaninov for me somehow.
Interesting.
Because of this DS, I mean, you know, there's always this DSC, there's always that, I mean, in the end of bells.
I'm thinking of Vespers.
Vespers, yeah.
That I heard in a church in Petersburg. I mean, these bass voices that come out of the center of the earth. I mean, my God, it sounds like you can do it.
I was studying singing, but I'm not as deep as those guys.
And this is Rachmaninov.
Yeah.
You have spoken about, you know, before you perform, before a concert, there are 1,000 voices in your head. I wonder if these philosophical, cosmological, almost theological reflections about where does this music come from? Who am I serving? What's it about? Are they among the thousand voices?
Yes, absolutely.
What are they saying?
Yeah, they're saying you are not a good guy. It's interesting. These theological, philosophical, to be or not to be questions are, of course, they are among these thousand voices. Say, well, you can't do anything. You can't. It's too early for you to conduct this piece or that piece. Of course, these voices are there all the time. But the voice is saying that what you should express through this piece. This is a, you know, it is you should perform this piece, whether it's Tchaikovsky 6 or now comes the Rite of Spring next. I mean, this week. Somebody says, yes, you can't produce just a professional way and just the music. So it says that you have to be emotionally involved with all your professionality and your personality as well.
Where does Rite of Spring come from? I have to ask.
Oh, that's great. It's one of the greatest pieces. I mean, I always discovered again and again. Always, I have performed it many times, playing in the orchestra myself, conducting as a ballet and conducting in the concert, and listening to, of course, the different recordings and live performances. And it's there is actually a lot of this, what we talked about, this, you know, of this orthodox, in a way, mystic, natural, wild thing, you know. This, of course, in Stravinsky, it's not, I wouldn't call it religious at all, in a sense of Christianity, of course there is a search for explanation, what explanation or trying to find what it is, you know, what the world means. What it's not just a compositionally perfect work with a great instrumentation, amazing instrumentation, use of instruments and revolutionary. It's not just that. It is, to me, the most, what emotionally, what the shock it brings to you when you listen to that music, what, as you know, as well as, of course, as a professional, novatorism, what the piece brings. But I think if you speak only, oh, it's the first time when he used the bass drum as in this way, or he used that, it's interesting, but it does not bring you as emotional satisfaction. So it's not enough to realize as a conductor or a musician just, oh, now I have a crescendo, the bass drum, for example, you know, it's the first time ever, you know, normally bass drum only has but to use it as in that kind of way, or any other instrument never been used in a combination of alto flute and flageolet, violin, or this is, of course, all genius and you just can admire, but actually what emotional feeling does it give to you? I think it's also, even Stravinsky is maybe not flirting but coquetting, saying, oh, it's not emotional, it is so much what is inside the human soul. I feel energized, energized. I mean, it's, you know, it's wild, energized, and, you know, it's really natural. It's also like, I mean, when we perform Sibelius, it's in a way Sibelius in a different way, but it's this earth connection with human as a, to earth, as a, not trying to be better than we are, or trying to be cleaner, or trying to be, to put ourselves much higher than animals, or, you know, it's somehow very earthy and very, that's what it would bring. So you feel energized from the earth, but also you want to take a shower.
Maybe you'll start another riot with it this time. come back to Boston for a moment. You speak of music as architecture, among other things.
Yeah.
And I want to know what you're building here. What do we need here? What do young listeners need? You know, in this age of Spotify, in the age of ever-present music that doesn't begin to grab us the way yours does in this hall.
Yes, well, I think, again, it is to knock to the hearts and souls of these young people or any age to infect them. And we can only infect if we, besides the great professional level, but we are emotionally willing and fully charged ourselves. You know, that's what we can do practically in the concerts. We play with full emotionality. And then I think the Rite of Spring, I mean, people want to come to concert, of course. I mean, they can hear jazz, they can hear Duke Ellington, you know, pam pa 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 ra pam pa pa pi ta ta, you know, bassoons. Or there is a early rock music, or it's all the rhythms, you know, and but, so it's, you know, that, so that means that I think that music can absolutely talk to any young audience member, as of course, as also as any age, because it brings the emotionality so wide. It's just what we need to present it and infect the audience.
I think people have to be reminded how different the experience is. The experience in the hall, the excitement in your concert, especially around Goodbye Dulina, was just breathtaking. People went out changed. How many other pieces are there in your arsenal that could have that effect?
I mean, there's so many geniuses. I mean, to me personally, Wagner was the first who, when I was 5 years old, who just hypnotized and infected me. So I was hypnotized by his music, and I was in love with his music, with Wagner. So it gave this mystic, long, not comfortable feeling, but mystic and
A piece, an opera?
Yes, an opera, Wagner operas, yeah. First was Tannhäuser, yeah. And of course, then it's Tristan, then it's Parsifal, The Ring. And I mean, I'm in love. I mean, this mystical, the length of it and this, and the sound world, I just need it as a food, you know, I need to hear. The same with Shostakovich, for example, Shostakovich symphonies, it's really, you know, and of course, you can't hear it all the time. Then you need Beethoven, you need Brahms, because you need comfort. You need somebody to say, you know, somebody with his music saying, "Don't worry, I know the life is difficult and hard, but everything will be fine." And you know, and we need just to accept life, and there is a future. I mean, that, and you listen to Brahms, and you get that, or you feel you want to, you know, depressed, you just go and listen to Bach, or you feel that, you know, you're not emotional enough. You just, well, you know, you've been sitting in the office too much, and you just, oh, you know, you got a bit, pedantic. You just go to opera and listen to Puccini opera, you know, and you would immediately cry, and you immediately want to go home and say, "I love you" to your children and wife, you know. So, and of course, also contemporary music for some. So some people maybe you know, I don't know, Goodbye Dulina, or Brett Dean, or John Harbison would directly go to their heart to touch them more than others. Mm. So it's very individual. It's really, but I think it's just simply stay to the roots.
Let me say, it's always fun for the audience to see after the piece is played, the conductor comes back and he will recognize individuals, the timpanist or the horn player, or could be anybody who's had a solo or done something remarkable. And it is a wonderfully sort of family gesture and loving in its wonderful musical way. But I see you reach out, you lean forward over those players, and you're doing it as the music is underway. And it's a lovely thing to be part of.
Thank you. Of course, I'm like a big child. I think and I hope I will to stay like that. I mean, music expresses our inside world. And for me as a conductor, if I, you know, I think in order to have the chemistry with the musicians I make, it's extremely important. If I, you know, if we perform and we are not on the same ship emotionally, or I don't believe that we can perform any piece honestly very, very well. If me as a conductor just, let's say, I have dictated, let's do this tempo, but I haven't convinced emotionally. I'm like, okay, people, of course, playing and giving their best, and they're professionals, and they would play without a conductor. But I think we need to be in one ship. It's a respect to each other. Of course, it comes from to respect to each other, encouragement and kind of this close human familiar feeling, which consists of humanity and in a love, in a way, you know, I love my musicians and and I respect them, and I think if they have this feeling, then they can perform emotionally, they can show that, I encourage them to show their emotion, you know, not to be to be shy or to, but of course it goes together with the professional, as it, you know, a knowledge, experience, professionality, and the tradition. Of course, it is not a only spontaneous, feeling. But of course, I believe if you perform Tristan or how can you perform it if you don't love? For example, loving my family. I mean, if you don't love, if you don't experience love, I mean, you know, it's your family, it's your, I mean, or daughter, or, you know, my wife, or my parents. If you, it all comes through the small things, and then it can spread. It's like a chamber music, love chamber music. It all starts with your family. And if you love your family and you experience that, then you can share, and you can also love in a wider range. And I think sometimes it's easier to invent an airplane than to really learn how and to experience real love, for example. And it's something, you know, and it's actually worth much more to raise a child as a good person than to invent an airplane. I think, of course, that's also in the Bible, says if you have 20 millions and if you give 1 million away, and then if you have 2 cents and you give 1 cent or two, all that away, the one who gave 2 cents gave more. So that is a...
Oh. Anders Nielsen, thank you so much for the conversation. Thank you for your work. Thank you for the life you brought into this town again.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Great pleasure.
Going out on another recent performance under Anders Nielsen's. This is from Jan Sibelius's Earthy Second Symphony. Connor Gillies recorded and edited our conversation with Anders Nielsen with help from producer Max Larkin. George Hicks is our engineer. Special thanks to Bernadette Horgan and the musicians and engineers at the Boston Symphony Orchestra for providing high-fidelity recordings of their work for our program. Mary McGrath is our concertmaster. For more conversations on arts, ideas, and politics, please visit our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time on Open Source.